and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, almost immediately after Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that the U.S. government would be willing to hold talks with the North Korean government without any pretext, President Trump jumped in and said that no such thing would happen. Meanwhile, South Korean President Moon Jae-in arrived in China on an official visit. Next, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was grilled today by the House Judiciary Committee over text messages exchanged between an FBI agent and his girlfriend, who happened to be a Justice Department official. Those text messages were less than complimentary toward President Trump. Rosenstein stood by his employees and by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. But should the president and the American people be worried about FBI agents who can't remain neutral? Then, President Trump unleashed a tweet storm yesterday attacking New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand after she called for him to resign, and on the same day that a documentary film was released on Trump's history of sexually harassing women. Trump said on Twitter that Gillibrand had asked him for money in the past and that she would, quote, do anything, unquote, for it. And then we talk about state elections in Gujarat, India, where the party of Prime Minister Modi is locked in competition with the Congress Party and its new leader, Rahul Gandhi, of the famed Gandhi clan. And finally, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation met in Istanbul today to condemn President Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem and to announce that the OIC would recognize East Jerusalem as the permanent capital of Palestine. Have American policies begun to cause a diminution of American power in the Middle East? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to China and the Koreas. Almost immediately after Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that the U.S. government would be willing to hold talks with the North Korean government without any pretexts, President Trump jumped in and said that no such thing would happen. Meanwhile, South Korean President Moon Jae-in arrived in China on an official visit. We're joined from London by Jude Woodward. She was London Mayor Ken Livingstone's advisor on culture and creative industries and is the author of the new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And we're also joined from London by Keith Bennett, a China expert who has visited China hundreds of times and currently advises both British and Chinese companies. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Good to be back.
Hi. Thank you.
So what should we make about this? You know, here in the United States, we're frankly embarrassed that this is not the first time or even the second or third time that the Secretary of State has come out and said something on North Korea, something quite important, actually, as in we're ready to hold talks with no pretexts. And then the president jumps in, usually by tweet, and says, we'll do no such thing. Or you can't trust the little rocket man. Or no, we're not going down that path. It's embarrassing. It demeans us in front of our foreign partners. And frankly, I think it makes us a weaker country. What are they saying about these kinds of things in China? Let's start with Jude.
Well, to be honest, I don't know what they're saying in China. But I think what's clear is that you have a revolving door in the White House. And there are differences. Trump has been unable to build a stable foreign policy team right up to the level of the Secretary of State, with people being shifted around from one position to another. And I think this is not the first time Tillerson has said that he thinks that the talks are necessary with North Korea. Steve Bannon, who's also out of the White House now, although still very influential, obviously, also said he thought there was no military solution and you had to have talks. But Trump has chosen to specifically contradict Tillerson on two occasions. And obviously the speculation is rife that his days are numbered as Secretary of State. But this is really just the whole crisis going on in the foreign policy of the U.S. presidency. I mean, it's hard to say what U.S. foreign policy is in many respects at the moment.
Yeah, Keith Bennett, let's talk about Moon Jae-in's trip to China. Because, of course, South Korea and China are the other important entities in any kind of resolution of the issues on the Korean Peninsula. Of course, China had been very upset with South Korea. The previous president had allowed the THAAD missile deployment. Moon Jae-in, it was expected, would be something of a progressive when he came into office. But as the crisis developed between the United States and North Korea, Moon Jae-in adopted very harsh rhetoric. Yet this trip to China must be part of a something of a rapprochement. Talk about what it means.
I think it reflects something of a rapprochement, certainly. But it's not yet a done deal. The seeds for this rapprochement came when Moon Jae-in and Xi Jinping met on the margins of the APEC summit in the Vietnamese city of Da Nang about a month ago, and they agreed to try and move forward. But the THAAD issue is the terminal high altitude air defense system, which China as well as Russia see as a threat to their own security, even more in fact than a threat to the security of North Korea. That issue has actually not gone away. They have agreed to try and move beyond it. But since then, there's been a certain hardening of the Chinese position once again to actually see that this would be carried through in deeds, not just in words. And what they've extracted from the South Koreans so far is a so-called three-part agreement. One, that Moon Jae-in would not agree to any further extension of the THAAD system. Two, that South Korea wouldn't join in any regional anti-missile defense system. And three, that there would be no tripartite military alliance between the United States, South Korea, and Japan. Now, what a lot of observers are talking about is that these things are very much open to conflicting interpretations on either side, and therefore you could just be kicking the problem down the road, as it were, because the South Koreans will probably interpret particularly the last point about no tripartite military alliance as meaning something very formal, whereas China, I think quite reasonably, would see any kind of joint military exercise involving those three powers as a violation of that agreement. And such tripartite exercises have been going on literally within the last week. I think we'll have to see what happens. But as of now, it's noteworthy that no joint statement is planned between the two leaders, and they're expected to issue, in fact, separate statements at the end of the visit.
Jude Woodward, it was August 25 years ago that People's Republic of China recognized South Korea. Before that, and since its creation, China only had recognized the DPRK as a legitimate government in North Korea. That created a souring of relations, at least temporarily, between the DPRK leadership and China. Certainly the Kim Il-sung leadership did not expect that. Well, maybe they expected it. They certainly didn't want it. Nonetheless, here we are 25 years later. It's a fait accompli. There is a China-South Korea relationship. South Korea has emerged as a major economic power. It's gone through different iterations politically. Different political parties have been in the leadership. Now we have a presumably liberal Moon Jae-in leadership. Do you think that China is trying to, and maybe cooperating with Moon Jae-in and Russia, to create the atmosphere or the mechanism for a new set of negotiations on the Korean issue, on the Korean DPRK nuclear issue?
Well, I'm sure that's what China would like to achieve. And I think that's a legitimate thing that everybody wants to achieve. But the problem, of course, is the US. Just on the recognition of the Republic of Korea, I think China was completely correct to do that. It was unfortunate for the DPRK it created some problems for the DPRK, but it was unavoidable for China to recognize the ROK. The problem is that the US refuses to recognize the DPRK. That's the problem. The problem is the US all the way along the line. It's a completely correct and legitimate course for China to pursue, to try to lock South Korea into a tripartite arrangement with Russia, to try and apply pressure to the US to enter into talks with North Korea. I think that's a very legitimate course to pursue, and I'm sure it's one that China is attempting to pursue. I'm sure that I think there is some agreement. I agree very much with what Keith said, that there is no done deal because the THAAD question hangs over everything. But I think on North Korea, I think there is broad agreement with Moon Jae-in that the right course is to try to lever the US into a situation where it has to agree to talks. And Moon Jae-in has even been prepared to make some concessions on that to Pyongyang by recently saying that any further tripartite military exercises should be scaled down and that type of thing, which at the moment are small steps, but they indicate there's some genuine commitment in South Korea to that course.
Brian, I'm a novice on these issues related to the two Koreas and relations with China. Explain to me why this would be in South Korea's interest. Would it not be in South Korea's interest to try to wait out Donald Trump and to sort of hope and press for a return to what had been a more traditional American policy toward North Korea?
Well, actually, because we have 2 minutes left, let's throw that back to Keith Bennett.
Sure.
Keith, what's your thought on that?
Well, I think that the problem with just waiting out Donald Trump is that he's such an unpredictable character, and who knows what will happen in the in the period while you're waiting. I think there's a degree of urgency, and I think that note of urgency is coming particularly from China much more so than normal, even within the last few days. It's significant that the Financial Times today has said that has analyzed that in many experts' view, China is now trying to pursue a triangular diplomacy through this visit of Moon Jae-in, which they say is aimed at averting U.S. or heading off U.S. pressure for more U.N. sanctions against North Korea, and trying to use what the Financial Times calls the incentive of better economic ties with China to tempt Seoul away from a hardline position against the DPRK. And obviously that incentive is very important because of the THAAD dispute, there have been a lot of unofficial sanctions imposed by China on South Korea, which are really hurting the South Korean economy, particularly at a time when Trump is threatening the free trade agreement.
Indeed. Jude Woodward, 30 seconds left. You get the last word. Go ahead.
Well, I really can't add very much to what Keith said, but I think that's exactly what's going on. I think there's China, there is concern in South Korea anyway about Trump's policy. So that's aiding the Chinese position. And China is trying to assert it, engage in diplomacy in order to create some leverage on the United States by tying South Korea into that kind of policy, which I think is what South Korea wants anyway.
It's very interesting. All around the world, from the Middle East to Asia Pacific, the U.S. is abandoning or being pushed aside and as its preeminent post-World War II role as the ultimate guarantor of
just like the Middle East
of all things, like all things. We've been joined from London by Jude Woodward. She was London Mayor Ken Livingston's advisor on culture and creative industries, and she is the author of a new book, The U.S. versus China, Asia's New Cold War. And we've been joined from London also by Keith Bennett, a China expert. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was grilled today by the House Judiciary Committee over texts exchanged between an FBI agent and his girlfriend, who happened to be a senior Justice Department official, that were less than complimentary toward President Trump. Rosenstein stood by his employees and by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. But should the president and the American people be worried about FBI agents who can't remain neutral? We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. She is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Colleen, so glad you could join us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Colleen, should we make anything of these texts? Do these texts really matter?
Well, you know, this was old J. Edgar Hoover's worry and why he actually put the strictest versions of the Hatch Act into place on the FBI all those 47 years. In fact, I think the FBI was singularly under the most strict provisions of the Hatch Act, which means you were not allowed to even mention politics in the workplace. You couldn't wear a button. You couldn't you couldn't do anything. In fact, Hoover himself said that he didn't vote. And the reason for that was because of power. The fact is Hoover was most powerful. So the only thing he counterbalanced that with was that he did not want his people or himself to play politics. they were themselves the power politics. They didn't have to worry about partisan. And I should mention that what's going on now with this agent, Strauss, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Peter Strauss, who was caught in an extramarital affair and texting about how much they didn't like Trump and did like Hillary Clinton. That's unusual from the standpoint if you go back, you know, 15, 20 years, because actually most of the FBI, because of the law and order emphasis, probably would have voted Republican. At least most of the agents and the hierarchy of the FBI would have actually voted Republican, even though it was not ever talked about. So this is kind of a sea change. But I think there's one thing that reconciles it with is that in the scheme of things, the FBI is bending to power. And the Obama administration and Hillary, along with the CIA, you know, high ups of the CIA and the other intelligence apparatus, actually bonded pretty well, I think, with that Obama administration, including Hillary Clinton, including Brennan, and including others. And so I think that's kind of what explains the situation. But ideally, I think we would want some more emphasis on something like the Hatch Act, where you have professionals that don't get involved with partisan politics.
Just for our listeners, I want to explain what some of these texts were. There's a Politico article that ran today, and it says the exchanges showed Page and Strozek mocking Trump as early as mid-2015, responding to a Washington Post story about Trump saying it hadn't been proven that Russian President Vladimir Putin had killed anyone. Page wrote, "What an utter idiot." In a March 2016 message, Page exclaimed, "God, Trump is a loathsome human. Oh my God, he's an idiot." And Strozek replied, "He's awful." It says here, the agent sometimes expressed respect or outright support for Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. "God, Hillary should win 100 million to nothing," Strozek wrote in March 2016, calling himself a conservative Democrat. Quote, "Also, did you hear Trump make a comment about the size of his," you can guess the next word, "earlier? This man cannot be president," Page said later in an exchange. So this has gotten a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill pretty riled up. Should we read anything into this in terms of the investigation into, well, I guess we've been calling it Russiagate here. Can these FBI agents be neutral in such an investigation?
Well, I don't think Peter Strozek or the woman he was having the affair with were neutral at all. Obviously, what you just read, those texts show that they were very partisan. And I think there, you know, again, there's an explanation for this. There may be another explanation, too, which is that a lot of the foreign policy elites actually think that this is hurting America's prestige in the world with some of this kind of lowbrow Trump tweets, et cetera. So his inability to express himself in more euphemistic terms, diplomatic terms. So there are a lot of people across the board that think that's hurting America's prestige. And I think that would go way beyond Peter Strozek. I don't know that affects all of the people that were assigned to the Russia investigation. It may be that there are others. And to his credit, I'm not a big fan of Robert Mueller, but I think to his credit, Robert Mueller was wise to immediately, reassign Strozek as soon as he learned about these texts. So that remains to be seen. I think it would be proper for Congress people to delve into who has been assigned to work with Mueller. Obviously, that's a proper, after what has been found out about Peter Strozek, it would be a proper line of inquiry to at least find out what about the others assigned to this. I'm under the understanding that Robert Mueller did handpick a lot of these former ACE assistant U.S. attorneys that had. Yeah. So, I mean, he picks them because they have had a record of success. Now, the question is how many of them also felt the same way as Peter Strozek? Maybe some of them did. You know, they were also creatures of a certain environment. So I think, again, it would be proper to inquire into that. I don't know.
Peter Strozek, John and Colleen, was also assigned to be the one of the principal, perhaps the principal FBI investigator into the issue of Hillary Clinton's email server, the State Department's emails being in a private server. So I think part of the, maybe the most important part of the story, because anyone can agree with the idea that Donald Trump is a pretty bad representative of the United States or anything, in fact, because of the way he conducts himself. But if you have the person investigating Donald Trump's opponent, that would be Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State and using her email, State Department emails offline, basically, and thus not FOIA-able, concealed from any Freedom of Information Act. And the person he's in a romantic relationship with is another FBI agent, Lisa Page, and she's working for FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. And McCabe was the one who recused himself from the Clinton email-related issues 1 week before the presidential election. When you look at the whole thing, you sort of have to come to the conclusion these people could not have been even-handed investigators of Hillary Clinton. This was before the Russiagate thing was fully underway. That was a big investigation. If they're the ones who are investigating Clinton and they believe that Donald Trump, for whatever reason, is going to be a disaster as president or for their department, you'd have to say, well, look, these guys have a bias and thus really could not be an unbiased investigator. Do you agree with that, Colleen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in fact, it wouldn't be humanly possible. So the people who defend, we're so professional that we can rise above all these issues and all of these personal conflicts. I mean, this is actually what I wrote about Robert Mueller and James Comey to begin with. When you're in this kind of environment with these kinds of pressures and whatever, not to mention personal opinions, et cetera, it's not humanly possible. And that's, I think, what people have to stop putting anyone on a pedestal at this point and just understand that this in fact is why the whole body of conflict of interest has grown up. In fact, in a very hypocritical way, this is why we have a quote unquote special prosecutor, independent counsel, special counsel, all of these names. The reason is that they realized that the Department of Justice would not be able to be independent in a case where they have previous working relationships and previously, some level of bias and prejudice. It's not possible. And so why even delve into these things? Why not just understand that when serious conflicts of interest arise, that you have to actually pick someone that does not have the conflict of interest? I mentioned this in a talk recently about the fact that the Department of Justice's regulations are supposed to require that the investigators and that the special counsel himself is someone who is not in government. James Comey violated that when he picked the U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald in the Plamegate investigation. He violated that thing. And it's been, in my opinion, by picking Robert Mueller, it was violated again. The only argument is that, we need some ace top prosecutor who is so conversant in the ways of Washington that it has to inherently be this former insider. And again, I think that we just have to pick people that are doing the investigation that are going to be completely independent. Otherwise, you're going to end up in the situation we are now, where a large number of people are going to find it not believable.
Everything's become politicized. There are a couple of Republicans that spoke after the hearing. Louis Gohmert of Texas said, this is just not political opinions. This is disgusting political bias, and there's no way that it could not affect a person's work. But then Jerry Nadler, a Democrat from New York, said Peter Strzok did not say anything about Donald Trump that the majority of Americans were not also thinking at exactly the same time. So unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it at that. We were joined by Colleen Rowley, a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. She has been a great hero of mine, and we're happy to have her on the show. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We're going to be right back after this message.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
President Donald Trump unleashed a tweet storm yesterday attacking New York Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand after she called for him to resign, and on the same day that a documentary film was released on Trump's history of sexually harassing women. Trump said on Twitter that Gillibrand had asked him for money in the past and that she would, quote, do anything, close quote, for it. We are joined from Los Angeles by Abby Martin. She is the host of the Empire Files on Telesur. Welcome, Abby.
Thank you so much for having me on, guys.
Thank you. Abby Martin, this is obviously both a pivotal movement, the Me Too movement, and a pivotal moment because women who have not been believed, who have been humiliated, who have been targeted or demonized, attacked a second or third or fourth time, should they dare to come forward and report on abuse by men, by powerful men in the workplace or wherever. This is obviously an important moment, but at the same time, we see in the United States of America that all things that have social relevance or even a profound sort of historical relevance can also be politicized. In other words, taken advantage of by political elites. How do you see this playing out right now? Is that what we're starting to witness?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's pretty disgusting to see the politicization of the Democrats and Republicans' sexual assault. I mean, sexual assault should be cut and dry. It doesn't matter to me if someone's a Democrat or a Republican. That's just the bottom line. So it is vile to see them seizing on every victim and really politicizing it. We saw Roy Moore on TV 24/7 trying to politicize that race and defend Al Franken, let's say. Look, both are disgusting. We should be calling out both equally. You know, this latest tweet storm of Trump, it's hard to be surprised really anymore by this garbage person or have Trump's tweets set an even lower low, but here we are. I mean, he's clearly insinuating that this woman is a slut, right, who would perform sexual acts for campaign donations. It's just shocking. I mean, and it's ironic that he felt it appropriate to respond to a sexual assault allegation with a sexist smear, but that's just who he is. You have Huckabee Sanders saying, if you interpret this as something sexual, your mind's in the gutter. Come on, this is a man who joked about his penis size during the presidential debate. So I think that we can just get that out in the open. You know, but of course, in response to this, you're seeing a bunch of horrible takes from, you know, everyone from the USA Today saying Trump isn't fit to clean George W. Bush's shoes, more hagiography about war criminals, to the Associated Press saying Gillibrand got the fight she wanted. I think that that's pretty outrageous, too. I mean, who would ever want to be subject to this kind of targeted harassment and attacks from his base?
Abby, one of the things that's very interesting to me is, and we mentioned this actually yesterday on the show as well, five, I think it might even be six now, U.S. senators are calling on President Trump to resign, and 56 members of the House are calling on the president to resign. We haven't seen calls like this since the Nixon administration in the 1970s. I can't imagine the situation getting any better for Trump because he always doubles down on statements like this. He always provokes and he always picks and he just can't leave well enough alone. How do you see this playing out?
Yeah, let's talk quickly about those women. I mean, here we have 19 women victims who claim Trump sexually assaulted them. His official position is denying that they all happened, right? Claiming that every single woman is lying about the assault. As we know from statistics, that's just outrageous. Usually more than one is valid enough to take assault allegations seriously and say, okay, this is grounds to believe you. Their stories are all eerily similar, from him forcibly groping them, trying to kiss them, put his hands up their skirts. Don't forget his ex-wife, Ivana. Trump said he violently raped her during their divorce deposition. Look, I think that what we've learned during the election and now the presidency is that Trump is different than other politicians. Yes, while there's this kind of unprecedented heat on him, he's an untouchable super brand. This is why he won. I mean, his brand is being a terrible, racist, bigoted misogynist who tweets insane things and derogatory things all the time. That's why everything the media throws at him and continues to throw at him, I think, actually only helps him. It just illuminates this narrative that he's somehow fighting the deep state. And I think that even though we think Trump is a moron, and yes, he is a moron in many ways, you know, watching 8 to 10 hours hours of cable television every night, we have to remember again how he won the election on knowing how to manipulate the media, hijack the narrative. I mean, every tweet he writes sets this day's focus of what dumb as hell clickbait culture war people are going to be outraged at, whether it's football players kneeling at the anthem, saying Merry Christmas. I mean, he knows his army of cultists will defend him to the death and deny, deny, deny. Meanwhile, the U.S. war machine rages on abroad, ramping up the worst and deadliest U.S. policies, steamrolling a radical evangelical agenda at home. So I honestly don't know if this is going to do anything to him.
Yeah, you know, as a longtime political observer, that's what confuses me the most. I've never seen a politician at this level so consistently and truly appeal only to his base. He never appeals to the center. He never tries to reach across the aisle. And he yet somehow still thinks that he's broadly appealing to most Americans. He thinks that he can win this next election by appealing only to, as Abby said, the misogynists, the haters, the Klansmen, the warmongers. He thinks that this is what Americans want.
Yeah. The other thing, though, is, as she is also saying, the media is so complicit, the corporate-owned media is so complicit with Trump. They say, you know, they want to beat him up, but it's CBS, it's CNN, it's not Sputnik or RT that made Trump a thing, because they gave him 24/7 coverage for all of that time. They made him a thing. And then he went out and he kept doing the same thing. I can remember, Abby, right after the Charlottesville right-wing fascist attack that took the lives of one of the protesters, the media was actually commenting. They were doing it constant, you know, wall-to-wall coverage, and they were saying, why hasn't the president tweeted yet? Why hasn't he tweeted yet? And I was thinking, like, oh, my God, this is the mainstream corporate-owned media. They've really been taken in tow by Donald Trump.
Absolutely. I mean, and you have the Democrats who have their slogan that I actually thought was an Onion article saying, look at the other guy, 2020. I mean, these people are the most incompetent. We think Trump's bad. The Democrats are even worse. He's doubling down on his base, folding in on the most extremist elements, right? And these are people who, like Alex Jones, who said they would die for Trump. I can't think of anything that would be worth being the center of that rage. So even though Gillibrand, I don't think this is some sort of political maneuver, of course they're going to use it just like they do everyone. They love to prop up these elitist politicians and senators as the resistance, right? As the people who are really fighting Trump. I mean, really, all they're going to do is use this attack as a campaign slogan for a presidential campaign. And they think that's all it's going to take to stand up to Trump on Twitter. She said this, he said that. 71% of young people want a third party in this country. That means that they want a group that's actually standing up to Trump in the system of oligarchic rule, representing the people in the streets. I mean, half the people are living in poverty in this country. They need someone to represent them, not just senators and congressmen who will just take to Twitter and say, you're a bad person, Trump.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
I totally agree with that.
I think so, too. And this is, you know, again, we've talked about this on this show. There really is a need for a viable third party in this country. People want it, especially young people.
And I have to say, I also think the Democratic sort of standard bearers within the electorate and people who identify themselves as liberals are turning out to be, I hate to say this, perhaps the dumbest part of the population, because now you have George W. Bush,
yeah,
with 51% approval rating among Democrats, because he happened to speak out about Trump and the Trump-Russia connection. I mean, and here's the thing, Abby, as you have pointed out many times, where's the accountability? I mean, were there 56 members of the House of Representatives calling on George W. Bush to resign for war crimes in Iraq?
Yeah, it's really sad. I'll never forget John Conyers and Nancy Pelosi saying impeachment was off the table. That's when I actually lost faith in the Democratic Party. I mean, that's when I realized that they were complicit in war crimes, and disastrous, deadly, murderous imperialism around the world. And I can no longer put my faith in them as a party. And it just goes to show you what's the priority here in America. Everyone is hyper-focused on this domestic, again, these culture wars. What is Trump tweeting? Meanwhile, we're bombing 7 countries. Trump has ramped up drone strikes over 400%. The rules of engagement out the window, where he's just carpet bombing entire neighborhoods. Obama killed every military-age male in a strike zone, but this is like way crazier. So the fact that that's not on the radar of the resistance, TM, you know, in Congress, it says a lot about the priorities of this country and what we're doing around the world with our tax dollars. And then speaking of tax dollars, let's talk about how sexual assault is dealt in Congress and how that big investigation is going to come out and expose at least 20 to 40 people. I mean, we're about to see a lot of moves happening there.
Yeah, this is a watershed moment, I really believe. I don't think it can possibly be business as usual on Capitol Hill, at least, anymore, and in Hollywood, perhaps.
Although the business as usual, as Abby's pointing out, we had the NDAA yesterday, the National Defense Authorization Act. Trump asked for $700 billion, and the Democrats and Republicans upped him another $40 billion. Yeah. So on that, they have complete unanimity. Abby Martin, 30 seconds left. Go ahead. You get the last word.
Yeah, so I think Trump helped create this context for the Me Too movement. I mean, he's a horrible person. His behavior toward women has only illuminated this widespread misogyny, sexual harassment happening everywhere, right? It's beautiful to see it happening. It's great to oust these predators. But remember, this is not only happening in entertainment and film. This is happening across every industry, probably even more rampant in sectors with women who have less recourse to stop it, like food, hotels, et cetera. It's very exciting to see that people are going to be ousted in Congress because, as we know, it's one of the most hidden agencies where we pay for the lawsuits that are settled. It's beautiful. But as we know, the right wing is going to double down, right? The right wing that likes to tout itself on family values is going to double down on defending pedophiles, rapists, bigots. So we have to understand it's going to be a treacherous road ahead. And we have to be critical thinkers, media literate, and navigate this terrain with an open mind and hold people accountable. Thanks so much for having me on, you guys.
Thank you for joining us. That was from Los Angeles, Abby Martin. She is the host of the Empire Files on Telesur. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're joined in this segment by Vijay Prashad. He is a professor and author of the book, The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution, and many other books. He's also with Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. We're going to be talking about the Indian state elections. Welcome back, Vijay.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyway, let's just kind of go over for our audience here in Washington, D.C. and other radio stations in the United States and around the world who may know, well, almost nothing about the state elections or the political system in India. What's happening now and how does it work and what's the significance of this upcoming election?
Well, India, like the United States, actually, is a federal system. So there are elections for a national parliament that take place every 5 years. And the last parliamentary elections we had were in 2014. The next election for the parliament will be in 2019. But between those elections, there are elections for the state government. That would be like having elections for the state of Massachusetts or New Jersey, et cetera. This is a very important election because it's for the state of Gujarat, which used to be the state where the current Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, was the chief minister. He was the chief minister for almost a decade and governed that state with an iron hand. His party has continued to rule that state, but it appears for the first time in almost two decades, it might suffer a defeat in this state election. I'd just like to say, in case people believe that this is a rather meaningless subject to discuss, that the population of the state of Gujarat is 62 million. And you might want to know that's the size of the population of France.
Yeah.
Right. Good
right.
point.
And it's often overlooked about just the size of India. And also, what would be the effect if Modi and his party lost the election in this state where he comes from? What would its impact be on the national standing of the BJP?
Well, this is a very important question, and it's not clear exactly what this will do because we haven't seen anything quite like this. So Mr. Modi, as I said, ruled Gujarat with an iron fist he got into, I think, a very serious controversy when in 2002, under his watch, there was a horrible pogrom in the state. And, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of Muslims were killed in that pogrom, state-sponsored pogrom, for which reason, by the way, Mr. Modi was denied a visa by the U.S. State Department to enter the United States. That visa denial lasted till he became prime minister. That was for a decade. So, you know, since Modi's departure from the state, a series of contradictions have emerged inside the state. The most important contradiction is Mr. Modi used to tout Gujarat as a success for business and, you know, a place where you could see the so-called Modi model of the Indian right shining. You know, unemployment was to be seen as low, business was humming, investment was humming, and so on. That has, of course, unraveled in the last few years. Unemployment has reared its head. Internal tensions, social tensions have come since certain caste groups, social communities have begun to demand reservations in government jobs. So new movements have emerged in Gujarat that have broken the kind of very well-knit together alliance of different castes in the Hindu community particularly that Modi had cultivated. So it appears, therefore, because of this, you know, unemployment question, the, I think, a false mask of foreign direct investment. You know, it's very easy to say we got so much investment coming into a state. But the question is, investment might come in, but how much profit is going out? And, you know, that was not looked at. Modi was very good at the shell game. He would point consistently at foreign direct investment, saying, look, there's a lot of money coming in to the diamond sector, to the, you know, petrochemical sector, etc. People were not looking carefully at how much profit was being repatriated, particularly by multinational firms, but as well by Indian firms who were based elsewhere. Corruption, repatriation of profits, unemployment, all this stuff which was there during Modi's tenure has now been emerged in a kind of political sense. That is, that there are now movements on the street in Gujarat demanding accountability, which means Modi's party might very well lose. If it loses, then the calling card that Mr. Modi had on the national stage, which is that he had sorted out Gujarat, begins to look less appealing for the public in general.
BJ, for our listeners who don't know anything about Gujarati politics, including me, I wanted to tell them that state elections go for quite a period of time. They began on December the 9th. They continue until December the 18th. But starting tomorrow, Indian pollsters are allowed to begin releasing the results of their exit polls. And so we should have an idea beginning tomorrow of what this election is going to look like. We've been talking a lot about Modi, Prime Minister Modi, but let's talk a little bit about Rahul Gandhi. He's the new head of the Congress Party. He has a long and proud family tradition in Indian politics and quite a proud name. The press here in the United States likes to say that that this state election in Gujarat could actually make something of Gandhi. It could make him a force to be reckoned with right now in Indian politics. Would you agree with that?
Well, look, it's unfortunate that the party that emerged out of India's freedom movement has been captured by a family. I mean, before Rahul Gandhi became the head of the Congress Party, his mother, Sonia Gandhi, ran it for 19 years. And before that, it was his father, Rajiv Gandhi, and before that, his grandmother, Indira Gandhi. I mean, there is something unseemly about India's very proud freedom movement being captured by one family. But nonetheless, one should also recognize that Rahul Gandhi himself, at age 47, is not much of a politician. You know, in a different world, he would have done something else. He might have become an artist. He might have gone into some sort of movie industry. He's not by instinct a politician. He's by family a politician. But this means that then one looks at who's around him. Because after all, he is merely the figurehead of a party that has been unable to, produce other leaders. It's faction-ridden and the factions are held together by the Gandhi family. So around him, he has pretty smart people, actually, including an old friend of his, Mr. Sindhia. You know, he has people who have guided him quite well in this Gujarat election. In other words, they were able to convince longstanding Congress leaders not to fight in their seats and instead turn over those seats to independent activists from the ground, people like Jignesh Milwani, who's running a very tight race against a BJP candidate and might very well win. So by doing this, they've in fact linked the Congress after many years to the big social movements against unemployment and social inequality in the states. A very smart decision. I don't think Rahul Gandhi thought this up by himself, but certainly his advisors have said, instead of going with the sort of people that we generally go with, let's open some space for the social movements. And I very much hope that this strategy is going to work for them in Gujarat. If it does, it might help in revitalizing the Congress Party. The problem for the Congress Party is it was the Congress that essentially opened up India to the neoliberal policy slate. So it has no feet upon which to stand when it criticizes the Hindu Rights Party, the BJP. So if there is now a new social justice agenda that starts to enter the Congress, India might very well get what it has needed for a very long time, which is a kind of social democratic party. The Indian communist left is very strong, but it cannot by itself, you know, change the culture of Indian politics. You require some sort of socialistic party in that breach between the right and the communists. You need alliances. You need to build a political culture that is different from what we have now. The communists are isolated. They cannot do it alone. So it would be, I think, very good for Indian politics if after this Gujarat election, the Congress Party moved in a social democratic direction.
Vijay Prashad is our guest. Vijay, we have about 90 seconds left. Just a quick question. Given the fact that the Congress Party is trying to sort of reinvent itself and have a social justice agenda, and the Communist Party of India, Marxist, and the communist movement generally is so large but still unable to become the ruling party in society, is it possible, is it likely, and will the state election have any impact on a possible united front that would be offered perhaps by the Communist Party of India, Marxist, or the other communist movements with Congress Party? Is that likely? Now I've taken up all of our time. We have 30 seconds left. That's a big question, and you have, well, you have less than a minute. Go ahead.
Well, very quickly, the communist movement will not go into any kind of electoral understanding with the Congress because the Congress is still wedded to a neoliberal policy slate. This doesn't mean that after parliamentary elections, it doesn't mean that the communists would not in some way support a Congress government. We had that arrangement in 2004. There was a common minimum program that the communists drew up alongside the Congress and held the Congress to. And when the Congress betrayed the common minimum program, the communists walked out of the government. So there is a way in which the communists could work with the Congress, but it will not come at the expense of the communist program. The price on the table is for the Congress to withdraw its commitment to the neoliberal policy slate. That's the minimum demand. Anything less than that is not possible.
Okay, that's all the time we have. We've been joined by Vijay Prashad. He's a prolific author. He is also now with the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. The latest book is The Death of the Nation and the Future of the Arab Revolution. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Organization of the Islamic Conference met in Istanbul today to condemn President Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem and to announce that the OIC would recognize East Jerusalem as the permanent capital of Palestine. Have American policies begun to cause a diminution of American power in the Middle East? We're joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Masoud, public opinion and governmental opinion across the region, the Middle East I'm speaking specifically about, seems to be rock solid on this issue. So many countries, and I'm not talking only in the Middle East, but look at the European Union as well. So many countries believe that the Trump administration has made a terrible mistake by moving this embassy to Jerusalem. Are you seeing the same thing?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the fact of the matter is that this is the occupied territory under international law. It's not a part of State of Israel. And if it's not part of it, it cannot be its capital. I mean, that really is as basic as that. I mean, this is unlawful.
Masoud, you just don't understand. Donald Trump in his speech said Israel is a sovereign country and thus it can put its capital wherever it wants to.
Yeah, including probably Washington and California.
Like, you know, any country can just decide, we're going to make our capital. Let's make Mexico City the capital of the United States.
You know, interestingly enough,
Buenos Aires.
There's a similar problem between Greece and the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia right now. The former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia is calling itself Macedonia. Northern Greece is called Macedonia. The Greeks see this as an infringement upon their sovereign rights and sovereign territory. Well, we see the same thing in Palestine. If the Israelis just say Palestine is ours and East Jerusalem is ours, well, that doesn't make it so. So I'd like to know why the Trump administration, why the American government supports the right position between Greece and the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia when there's an almost identical situation taking place over Jerusalem, and we take exactly the opposite tack.
I think the whole world is in shock because they just didn't really expect even Donald Trump to sort of say such a stupid thing and such a bizarre thing and which doesn't resolve any issue. It actually, all it does, it creates further complication and problem. Look, the reality is that United States, the whole history of U.S. administration's policy towards the State of Israel has been a total support, you know, with the veto, with the finances, with arms, you know, you name it, you know, there has been sort of support for the State of Israel to the extent that Israel could not survive without finances from United States. And while Israelis are sort of benefiting from free education and free healthcare, Americans cannot afford that. But they have made it possible for Israelis to afford that and to have that pleasure. Now, the reality is that for a very long time in the region, people are talking about the fact that the two-state solution, i.e. having an state for Israelis and a state for Palestinians next to each other, even sharing Jerusalem or not, it's dead and it's not going to happen because of the fact that Israelis are not going to play ball and they don't have to because there's no pressure put upon them. And now, we all know this two-state solution is dead. Now the two-state solution is actually buried by Trump and his decision to sort of go so outrageously supporting illegal occupation and, you know, allowing it to sort of legitimize that. I think in some ways, really, I think there is a silver lining in the cloud. And the fact is that I think the international community now has to realize that probably this idea of having two opponent states next to each other and then supporting one against the other and, you know, one bombs the other one and et cetera, is not going to create any solution. Probably we should go eventually for one state solution. So every person in that piece of land actually gets a vote and decide what should be their future. Get rid of the racism, get rid of all the aspect of, you know, first-class citizens, second-class citizens. And that indeed, I think, will be a more feasible solution than what is being presented up to now. And I think to some way, what Trump has done with the foreign policy regarding Palestine-Israeli conflict has actually removed the mask from this policy. Not everybody sees that United States cannot be a sort of honest broker, which has been claiming to be. Just look at the history of the support for the State of Israel. And I think now we should start thinking sort of in a completely different roadmap.
Let me ask you about that, actually, because that was an important point that Mahmoud Abbas made today in Istanbul. He said that the U.S. had disqualified itself, his words, the U.S. had disqualified itself from any future Israel-Palestine peace talks after proving its bias in favor of Israel. Do you believe that the U.S. no longer has a role because of this decision?
I mean, if you go and ask any Palestinian, if you do a poll with the Palestinian community regarding this issue, I think something like 90% and probably more will say that, U.S. with his policy and his action in past 60 years have actually disqualified itself anyway. But what has happened now is so aggressively, so publicly, so blatantly, is actually disqualifying itself. You know, when he stands up and say, we have to sort of go along with the reality, what it means is that the Israelis have actually the building within occupied territories, and bit by bit, they could actually steal the land away. And then, you know, it's going to be called reality. And I think that sort of behavior is shocked the world to the extent that, you know, what happened in Istanbul, in Turkey, it was the sort of these, some of these people who actually had to show such an aggression against the policy of the United States are actually friends of US. They actually had to keep that sort of face, because if they don't, they will be sort of eaten alive by their own population. Now the international community can't sort of go along with policy of United States for the Palestine and occupied territories, and they're exposed.
Let me ask you about that, because Netanyahu went to Europe. Talk about what happened. You're in London, but talk about what happened in Europe and how this might be a game changer long term in terms of European public opinion, if you would.
Well, I think what we have had over the sort of many years, you know, going back 50 years and more, is that there is sort of policy basically has been engineered and by United States. The policy has been sort of articulated by United States, and there has been a consensus within the West and the European nation to follow that. And that goes along sort of two-state solution, recognition of Palestinians and recognition of Israelis, having them sort of live side by side and actually having each one of them having their own state. Now, that has been sort of the only game in town for a very, very long time. And one of the reasons it's been the only game in town has been because of U.S. Insistence that this is the only way forward. Now, by what Trump has done, it's actually shaken everything. I mean, Europeans cannot possibly go along with the sort of policy of United States of actually giving occupied territories and acting illegally. And this was articulated very vigorously by Europeans, that we cannot do anything which is unlawful. And so therefore, you know, I think now the whole thing is really opened up for Europeans are not going to go along with those policies. And European now could begin to start thinking their own policy and their own sort of way forward away from US, and they haven't got any other option. I think in some ways, this will be actually good for the region, because I think US and its sort of the way that the relation, the special relationship is between U.S. and indeed the state of Israel has been one of the greatest obstacle to come to peace. And Netanyahu came to Europe to basically woo them and encourage them to actually go along with the same policy. And he got extremely very negative response, and if anything, very aggressive response, that Europe will not go down the road of actually doing something illegal.
We've been joined from London by Masoud Shajarey. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can hear our show every day, Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. at 105.5 FM or 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear it at SputnikNews.com, or you can subscribe to it as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.